Weller, his left hook shot, made it, end of the line.
Bad pass, tipped away, and Indiana's got it. Up the floor to Oladipo. He will lay up, score! Jones. Watford for the win!
Yes! Yes!
It's Indiana. It's Indiana.
Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of Podcast on the Brink. Matt Dollinger here. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Greg Rosenstein. We are coming to you on Tuesday after the IU-Butler game. And, Greg, it looks like we nailed that one perfectly, didn't we?
Yeah, I think both of us said, 10-point wins for Indiana wouldn't be too hard. Yeah, that didn't actually happen.
Not quite. Luckily, we've got someone on the show today who actually knows what they're talking about. Rick Bozich from WDRB is joining us again this season to talk a little bit about IU Butler. How you doing today, Rick?
Doing great, man. We're in an old college basketball season. There's nothing to complain about.
That's right. And, you know, what a game on Saturday. It sure had the feeling of a March Madness game. Had to double-check the calendar to make sure it was December. You were up in Indy for the game, covering it. What was kind of your overall impressions from it? Obviously, you know, incredible overtime win by Butler.
Yeah, I mean, it was a phenomenal environment. I mean, they were selling standing room only tickets, which I don't remember when I've seen that for a college basketball game. And, you know, IU fans were in every part of the building. But Butler, more so than Notre Dame or Purdue, had the second largest turnout. I mean, they've got a very devoted and feisty fan base. And once Butler set the tone early on that they weren't going to back down from Indiana. In fact, they were going to take it to Indiana. That just sort of energized their crowd as well as the Notre Dame and Purdue crowds and their team. And I think that was the key of the game. That I remember last year when Indiana upset Kentucky, I thought Indiana took it to Kentucky, and that was the goal. And I thought in this game, Butler took it to Indiana. It was the more aggressive team, and I think that was the first key to their success.
Now, just sticking with that point, I think the biggest stat might just be offensive rebounds. You know, it seems so many times Indiana played good defense and then, you know, a bad shot was rebounded by Butler. And you look at some of these stats, I think, you know, it was almost 50% in terms of offensive rebounding percentage by Butler, and Zeller only had 5 rebounds, Watford 3. I guess, can you just talk a little bit about that aspect and how that kind of changed this game?
Well, it was key all through the game. And not only did they get the rebounds, they did something with them. There were a number of occasions where you could see Butler miss a shot, and then they would get the rebound, and it would turn into a layup, or a putback, or an easy basket of some kind. That was punishing. And then even they chased down a lot of loose ball rebounds, and the key one was when it was 84-83 in overtime, and Butler missed a three, and one of their players, I might have been Spigal, I don't remember who it was, it ran pretty much from one side of the floor to the other and chased that ball down. They hit another three to go at 86-84. And I talked to a couple of coaches I know about what was going on, and they said, you know, the problem is when you play Butler is you have to respect their perimeter shooting, especially with Rodney Clark and Dunham, although he didn't have a phenomenal game. So they space you out. And when you're spaced out like that, that's one of the things that they're able to do is they're able to pick up loose ball rebounds. There's not a knot of players underneath the basket. So part of it is the way Butler plays, and part of it I thought that Indiana, until the second half, I mean, the second half had changed, but in the first half, Butler was definitely the more aggressive team.
Yeah, and they definitely showed resiliency the entire way, you know, having players foul out late in the game and in overtime and you know, still not losing a step was really impressive. Rick, I kind of want to get your impressions on whether you thought Saturday's game was more, you know, of what Butler did right or what IU did wrong. It was one or the other, you know, standing out more than the other?
You know, I'm going to give credit to Butler. I mean, we're not talking about the Butler of 10 or 15 years ago. We're talking about a program that, you know, went to the NCAA championship game in 2010 and 2011 that has a good coach, that finished runner-up in the Maui Invitational and beat Carolina pretty decisively over there, that had been tested with some other games this year, including a game they lost to Xavier. But a week before, they went on the road and went at Northwestern. And, you know, we know it's just from following the Big Ten, that's not an easy thing to do. So I think the preponderance of the credit needs to go to Butler and the way they held together. Indiana has some things they need to do better, no question about it. I mean, as you mentioned, Zeller and Wofford have to be more assertive on the glass. There's no doubt about that. And they have to cut back on some of the unnecessary turnovers. I know that Yogi Ferrell hit the big shot, but I think his stats were six turnovers and three assists, and he made that one late in the game where he tried to throw that bounce pass to Zeller, and all he had to do was throw the ball up high and lay up. So just little things like that, fine-tuning. I mean, I'll give more credit to Butler.
Now, I'm a little bit curious about your take on Butler's final offensive possession. Now, they came down, and Crean took out both Zeller and Wofford, I think, and had holes guarding Butler's guard dribbling down the ball, and he ends up scoring. Now, obviously, it was kind of, I wouldn't say fluke shot, but he, you know, twisted around, threw it up, and it went in. I guess, would you have done anything differently there? Because to me, I just feel like when you have a seven-footer All-American like Cody Zeller to take him out on that final possession, he would have at least maybe altered that shot or something. I know Crean was saying some of it came down to being able to switch on guys. They were doing a lot of that. But what's your take on just that final offensive possession from Butler?
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that Cody Zeller wasn't out there. He's not a great shot blocker, though, and so I'm not sure maybe his presence there would have dissuaded Barlow from bringing it into the middle. But as I said, I talked to a couple of coaches, and they said what he said made sense. What Crean said makes sense about you're switching everything, so you're not going to have Zeller in there. But I guess the one place I would differ with that is if you're doing that, of the guys that were out there, I thought Jordan Holes is probably the least effective on-the-ball defender. So you might want to have five guys who are a little bit better of containing the dribbler and not a lot of the guy getting the lane. And, you know, it turned out that, I don't know if it was intentional or it was just a matter of circumstances, that he was isolated with Jordan Holes, and he went right down the lane and got a shot that bounced, what, three or four times before it went in. But if that's not a bad shot to get to win a game.
Yeah, you know, Crean got a lot of flack after the game for not having Cody in, and our friend Dustin Dopierak caught a little heat in the press conference afterwards for bringing it up. But
I mean, he should have made his point. I mean, he was clearly going after something there.
Yeah, someone had
to ask. I mean, it was a legitimate question. I mean, he should have just said, why wasn't Cody in there for the last defensive possession? That's what he wanted to say. And that's, I think, what Tom Crean questioned him on. So I think he eventually asked it that way the second time. And it was a question, I think, that needs to be asked and fans were asking. And it's the kind of thing that if the kid misses the shot and we go to the second overtime, then nobody's going to bring it up. But when it becomes a decisive play, it's something that people focus on.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, you bring up a good point, Rick. I think it's almost maybe more, questionable to have holes in the game at that point, because I think, you know, Cody is not a great shot blocker, like you said, but I actually think he's pretty good at switching on screens. We've seen him play really far away from the basket a couple times this year on defense, and obviously we know we can run the floor too. But you know, Hulls might be the only guy on the team, maybe outside of Yogi, where a guy can shoot over him easily or something. And you know, that shot was difficult by Barlow, but you know, it wasn't impossible. It was a pretty good look, and when he got it up, I thought it was going in just because of its proximity to the hoop. So you know, I do think, you know, no matter what happened, Crean could be, you know, questioned on it just because that's the nature. But, you know, having the game-winning shot come over Hulls was the thing that stood out to me. Greg, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, kind of like I said, I think Zeller is such a, like, a versatile big man. The way he gets up the floor, I mean, I just don't think it would have been that big of a deal if they, you know, had ball screens and everyone was switching. I just think he would have been okay. And I don't know if that would have been the exact play to have the guy just dribble straight down into the lane and then put up the shot. But if it was, I mean, I would have thought that a 7-footer up there would have at least not necessarily blocked it, but altered it, made it a little bit tougher than it was. And like you said, I think Hulls probably wasn't the best option there to guard him, because even I think Remy is a better defensive player, obviously Victor, there's so many options at that point. But yeah, it really doesn't come down to that one play. I think overall, overtime in general was not good, because you're having, you know, two of their top players out and all the momentum was kind of on your way. For them to lose overtime like that, I think was huge.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just that shot. I mean, if you look at Butler's stats for the overtime, they made 5 out of 7 shots. If you can't, I don't know if it was more than 7 possessions, but let's say it was 7 possessions. you've got to get more stops than that. And that's, you know, the last play lost the game, but when it was 84-80, needed to get a stop there, and then you score them, and you got maybe a three possession lead. Instead, it goes 84-83, and then 86-84, and the pressure shifts back to Indiana.
Right, and then you know, look, they got a lot of open looks from the perimeter in that overtime, especially, and I think that was a big deal. I mean, they got knocked a lot for having bad post defense, but at the same time, perimeter defense was, I think, just as bad. Now, kind of staying with that, though, Jordan Hulls, who is one of the best shooters in the country, only took 2 3-pointers in that game. I mean, do you think that was Jordan not being aggressive enough or the team not getting him enough open looks? And overall, I mean, do you think that's a problem going forward, not getting him enough shots from beyond the arc?
It's kind of a combination. That I think that Butler, as I said, is well coached, and I'm sure that's one of the things they game plan for is how do you limit Jordan Hulls' open looks on 3-pointers. They did a good job of it, and part of it is when we've seen this over the length of his career that there are games here or there where he's not aggressive looking for a shot, and this was one of those games. And for whatever reason that happens, whether you can't be that aggressive every game or whatever it is, this was one of those games. So that you combine the two things together, and you know, it ended up being a night for Oladipo, and Zeller ended up with 18, and you know, they got stuff from Yogi late. But Hulls, the way he played in New Jersey and the way he played this year, this was really the first game where you looked at him and said he really wasn't looking for a shot enough. So I'd say it was both.
Well, what about the debate about, you know, non-conference scheduling? IU's has been pretty easy this year outside of UNC and Butler. And I thought maybe they were caught off guard a little bit by the atmosphere on Saturday. And, you know, maybe that contributed to their free throw woes. Do you think that, you know, the Hoosiers will ultimately benefit from playing in a game like this? And maybe they should have, you know, more of these early season challenges?
Yeah, I think they'll benefit from it. I mean, it certainly wasn't as difficult an environment as they're going to find on the road, starting on New Year's Eve at Iowa, and then going to Ohio State and Michigan State and Illinois and some of those places they're going to go. But I think it's good to play at least one road game in the non-conference. I think it's beneficial to your team. I know that Rick Pitino had a few years ago where he didn't play any, and they got blasted in the first game in the Big East, and he's kind of changed it since then. You know, looking at Indiana's schedule this year, I think they thought going to New Jersey that Georgia was going to end up being a better team than they are, and some better, that should have been better than 2-7. You know, Georgetown, that's the only game they've lost is Indiana, so that was a good win. And I don't think anybody in preseason North Carolina was pretty much consensus, what, top 15?
Yeah.
Some people just looked at their talent said top 10. They haven't turned out to be that good. So part of it is just that some of the teams they're going to play haven't turned out to be as good as people thought. And, you know, North Dakota State, I know that people laugh at that. If you look at their record, they're pretty good. They have a good chance to be an NCAA tournament team. That was a good win, really. And I know people aren't going to give me credit when they say North Dakota State. But
yeah.
Overall, yeah, I mean, I would like to see one road game. I think that's good. And I'll have one next year there in the ACC and challenge again, but I think it's good to play a road game. They would have played Kentucky on the road this year. That would have been the road game, and they wanted to go to Rupp, and it didn't turn out that way. So I don't know which game ended up being the replacement for Kentucky or Connecticut or whatever, but that would have been the road game.
Yeah, and if we talked about Kentucky, we'd be extending this podcast another 30 minutes probably. So we're not going to go there exactly. But Butler, you know, when I asked people on Twitter what their biggest reasons were for the loss, some people did say that Cream got outcoached, and he's going to have this Brad Stevens thing kind of over him for a while, even with Indiana having the number one ranking at this point. Do you think he was outcoached necessarily in this game, and do you think there's any kind of rivalry now maybe starting up between those two guys?
You know, there's probably parts of the game where Brad Stevens outcoached him, and there's probably parts of the game where Cream outcoached Brad Stevens. If you look at what Cream did in the final minutes of regulation and ramped up the full court pressure and turned Butler over, at that point of the game, he outcoached Stevens. And Stevens didn't have an answer for him in terms of how to handle Indiana's pressure. So, you know, so much of that is knee-jerk reaction to how the game turns out. I mean, Indiana could have done some things better, and Butler could have done some things better. in terms of the rivalry, yeah, I think it's going to grow. Because if you look at what was a very ambitious program, I mean, you look at where they came from, they went to the Horizon, they're now in the A-10, and there it certainly sounds like they're going to get an invitation to join this league with Villanova and Georgetown and Marquette and DePaul and some of these teams, and that's just going to increase their national profile. Unlike Thad Matta, unlike Licklider, Steven seems willing to stay there and maybe create a niche, this sort of a boutique program in the middle of Indiana at a smaller school, and I don't think they're going away. So I think, yeah, I mean, it's going to be a rivalry that hangs around. It'll be interesting to see whether they continue to play. I hope they do, because I think it's good to have, you know, two teams that close together. And in some ways, Butler, the program they're overshadowing is Purdue. I mean, Purdue is the one that's kind of fallen out of the limelight.
Yeah, and you know, I think IU fans would love to have a rivalry with Butler, mainly because I think a lot of IU fans have rooted for Butler in recent years. And I think that's another reason why, you know, maybe Hoosier fans aren't taking Saturday's loss as hard as maybe a loss to Kentucky or Purdue or something, because for a lot of people, Butler's their second favorite team. And, you know, with Brad Stevens being there and all the players they've had in recent years, they're very likable. And, you know, it's tough to root against a great underdog story like that. But they're not going to be an underdog story from too much longer if they keep pulling off wins like this. So maybe the tide would change. Greg, what about you? Do you think a rivalry with Butler would be a good thing?
Yeah, definitely, because it's so close to Bloomington. And like you said, I think people actually respect this team, just kind of how they've done things and the type of players they have. Not that Indiana doesn't respect Purdue or Kentucky. I just think, I don't know, people don't necessarily hate Butler, and they kind of like how they've gone about things. So I wouldn't mind to see if, you know, this kind of turned into a once-a-year thing even. That would be something good. Do you agree with that, Rick?
Yeah, I'd like to see him be on the schedule. I mean, I think it'd be good. I mean, you look at what Butler, the guy that made the winning basket is a walk-on who still doesn't have a scholarship and turned down Bellarmine in Northern Kentucky to go to Butler. I mean, Roosevelt Jones was recruited by Illinois State, Indiana State. I mean, Andrew Smith was a project. I mean, they don't. Rodney Clark was a high-profile guy that got him on the rebound because John Pelfrey got fired at Arkansas. Now they're starting to get some better players. Kellen Dunham was obviously an Indiana All-Star, and they've got some more guys coming next year. And if they keep winning, they'll continue to get some. So I mean, it's hard to dislike Butler because I think in many ways they do a lot of things the right way. And if you're looking at who you want to play, that's the kind of school I think you want to have on your schedule. And so instead of a school where you might have some other kind of issues.
Rick, before we let you go, I just kind of want to get your last impression on whether you think Saturday was kind of a blip on the radar for IU, or if you thought maybe it is cause for concern and there's some issues that the Hoosiers really do need to address before Big Ten season.
You know, I think it's mainly a blip on the radar. I mean, they lost by 2 points in overtime in the game they could have won. And so, you know, I go back and to the 76 team, which finished undefeated. They won an overtime game against Kentucky in December. I mean, I was there at that game. They were lucky to win it because Ken Benson kind of had a miraculous tip in to put the game into overtime, I believe it was. So, I mean, you're not going to just be a machine and roll through everybody. And give Butler credit that they played well. They wanted to win the game. It meant a lot to them because Indiana's number one. They're on national TV. You know, you got to give tip your hat and give the other team credit sometimes. Now, does it say anything about issues that Indiana has? I think if you look at the game, it's a couple of issues that people talked about before the season. Are they going to be good enough on the glass? And they weren't in the first half of the game. They picked it up in the second half, and even Tom Crean addressed it after the game, saying he was looking forward to the rebounding drills. And I think when you look at Indiana, when you're playing Hulls and you're playing Farrell, you're playing a pair of 6-foot guards. And against some teams, they're going to try and find ways to – that's what coaches do. They try and say, where can we best attack this team? And there were times when I think Butler took advantage of Indiana's side in the backcourt. So those are the things that, you know, as this team evolves, Tom Crean is going to have to deal with. Say, well, guess this team might have to play Remy Abel more. I now have to play Sheehy in the backcourt a little bit to see how I can stop some of this stuff from happening.
Yeah, it's definitely IU's first sign of adversity of the year, and it'll be interesting to see how they do adapt and react kind of before they face Iowa on December 31st.
I think it's a good thing. You know, these guys, you know, last year at this time, people were wondering if they were even legit after they beat Kentucky. This year, they've been patted on the back all summer. You know, everybody knew they were going to be ranked number one, two, or three. It's just natural at some point where, you know, you need to sort of get a reality check and say, hey, this isn't going to be a cruise control thing where we just roll over a lot of different teams. And I think, you know, a loss can be beneficial. And whether it is or not depends on how they react to it. I think we'll find out, but it's not a bad thing.
And it's a good feather in the cap for the state of Indiana. Two straight years, a team from the state has knocked off the number one team. Yeah. Just not the same one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that will tune in on. I mean, the next three games are with Mount St. Mary's and Florida Atlantic and Jacksonville are all at home. Indiana should win them all, and then on New Year's Eve, it'll be interesting to see when they go out to Iowa, which I don't believe they've won there the last couple of years, and they've had trouble with. Iowa's big guy a couple of times, and you know, it'll be interesting to see how they respond that game.
Definitely. Easy games do not come very often in the Big Ten. Every one of those will be a challenge, and we're looking forward to that as much as you know, the wins are nice. It's more fun to watch competitive basketball, so we're eager for the new year. Well, Rick, thanks so much for joining us on the program. We love talking to you, and hope to have you on again. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Anytime, guys.
All right. Well, to wrap up this week's show, we're going to pour into some tweets that Greg collected Saturday after the game. I guess IU fans had a lot to talk about, didn't they, Greg?
Well, I'm shocked that people actually responded to me. But surprisingly, I did get a decent amount of responses. Most were similar to other people. So I'm just going to choose a few here that I thought hit on some topics that maybe we didn't necessarily go over with Rick. And for instance, like one, Jeremy Deckard said, Butler simply out-efforted them in nearly every phase of the game. Didn't think I'd ever tweet that about this team. And I think I agree with that. I think it just seemed like Butler, I mean, this is typical Butler, but they just out-hustled Indiana in so many phases, especially, you know, being physical down low. I mean, should we be concerned with Cody and Watford combining for only 8 total rebounds?
Cody's, you know, performance was a little troubling just because, you know, you think about how he does against Butler and you wonder how he's going to do against teams like Ohio State and Michigan State and Michigan. You know, I think Butler, to their credit, game plan for Cody very well. If you noticed, you know, after Butler baskets or missed shots, Cody would run down the court, but someone was, you know, checking him the entire time. He wasn't able to get any of those easy baskets Saturday. So, you know, I give Butler a lot of credit for containing Cody. And I'm sure that was their number one game plan, you know, going in. The toughness thing, I think that's going to come from more games like this. You know, you don't build toughness in 40-point routes. You build toughness in overtime games. And even though IU lost, you know, I think this was a much more beneficial game on their schedule than the blowout over UNC or any of the other wins. These are the types of games you learn from and the types of games you draw on in March.
Yeah, and I mean, just the Watford thing, I hate to keep going back to it. I feel like we're beating a dead horse, but, I mean, he was like 1 for 5 from the field. He got basically all his points from the free throw line. I mean, that's good. He was able to hit free throws, and I guess he was a little bit tougher down low getting to the line. But it's like, at some point, you got to see this guy who some people said, oh, could be potential all-Big Ten player, finally play consistently good. I don't know. I mean, it would have been nice for him to show up in that game.
He's definitely still struggling to find his place in this new offense. It's not there yet.
Right. I'm trying to think if there's any other tweets here that's good. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, for instance, who was it? Here, for instance, Larry Shoemaker said, terrible rebounding and 11 missed free throws. Now, we touched on rebounding already, but that's true. I mean, 11 missed free throws. They shot something like 71% from the free throw line. That's not terrible, but at the same time, you're leaving 11 points out there. I mean, how big was that? Do you think, Matt?
Yeah, it was huge. And you know, as I kind of said earlier, I think it was nerves. I mean, this is a great shooting team. There's no question about that. There are not many bad free throw shooters on the entire squad, but this was their first, you know, pressure situation since Brooklyn, and maybe even greater pressure because they realized that an upset might be in the process. Those free throws definitely cost IU the game just as much as that last second shot. It's not as attractive to point to them and be like, that's the reason IU lost. But any coach will tell you that missed free throws are definitely kryptonite to winning. What about you?
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, again, I don't think they were terrible from the free throw line, but if you're up there and you leave 11 points on the board, basically, that's huge, especially in a game that went to overtime. So,
and especially when Butler, was fouling as much as they were, not giving up any easy baskets, you've really got to make those free throws count because, Butler had three players foul out, but ultimately it was worth it considering, IU struggles from the line.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'll give you one more. These two tweets are actually people we know. Jamie Owens from Inside the Hall, photographer. Brandon Earl Smith, friend of ours from Indiana. They hit on a couple of similar things. Brandon says, no Derek Elston. And obviously he wasn't ready health-wise necessarily. And Jamie Owens said, because Peter Jerkin didn't play. I mean, I don't know necessarily how much impact Peter Jerkin would have played, but I would have maybe liked to see Honor get a few more minutes. Don't you think if they're getting out-hustled, out-physical, down low, Watford's not doing much, Zeller's not doing much in terms of rebounding, I think it would have been nice to see maybe Honor play a little bit more down low. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely do. He did have one, that nice play where he made the bucket and got fouled, but, I think that's just a comfort issue with Crean not quite being ready to put them in the game, and as we talked about before the Butler game, I think these next three games are really going to be where Honor and Peter see a lot of minutes and, start to be worked into the rotation. I've got no idea what kind of player Peter Jerkin really is yet because I've yet to see him step on the floor, so I can't really say if he would have helped or not. But one guy I know who definitely would have helped would have been Derek Elston. And, to see him in the candy stripes and in his jersey on the bench, you wondered if he was going to get in the game. It sounds like, after Crean's radio show Monday night that he is close to returning. And, there's a guy who exudes toughness as much as anyone on IU's team, and his return is going to be huge for the Hoosiers.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I would say, though, I hope he doesn't necessarily go back to some of the things he used to do, which was just hover around the three-point line, kind of like Watford-ish. You want somebody who could kind of go in there, bang down low, post up guys. I don't know. I think it'd be important if he could kind of do more of that, I guess, with his game.
Yeah, well, we've seen Watford try and be a different player this year, likely under the coaching of Crean, and try and crash the board. So maybe Elston will be under similar orders and will be down low. But also, it is good that he can stretch the floor and shoot the three. And, when the Hoosiers play Big Ten teams with traditional post guys, Elston becomes more valuable because he is that versatile. But you're right. The last thing IU needs is a power forward who doesn't rebound.
Yeah, exactly. Here, I'll give you one more, actually. We already touched on Cody. This is something similar, but this is from James Cheatwood. He says they don't play through Cody enough, and he needs to be more aggressive. And I'd probably agree on both of that. This was a problem last year where, you're having this all-American, awesome freshman power forward down low, or center, if you want to call him center, and then they're not getting him the ball enough. And I think it's still kind of the same thing here. And I don't know if that's him not necessarily demanding the ball enough or them just not being a good enough or being good enough to get him the ball in the right situations. But I guess what's your take on maybe Indiana needing to play through him more?
Absolutely. And, it's not in Cody's personality to demand the ball or really call for it, but that's something he's got to work on because he takes high percentage shots. The shots he does miss, he usually gets fouled on. And, of all the IU outcomes on offense, the Cody Zeller shot is probably the best. And, like we did say, Butler did a great job of containing him, so that's a credit to him. You can't put it all on Cody, but, IU's players do need to look for him more because, if it's obvious to us, it's got to be really obvious to people who know what they're talking about. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And then also, I've been reading some NBA draft, mock drafts, that sort
look
of thing.
Look at you.
Well, as an NBA guy, as the diehard Wizards fan of this podcast, I have to see who we're going to choose with the number one pick.
Smart.
Yeah. So, Cody was maybe the number one pick going in. Now I see him sliding slightly. People are saying he's top five at least, which I think he's going to be no matter what. But one thing that people have been mentioning, and I've read like a bunch of these things, like he's not aggressive enough. He doesn't necessarily have that personality. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, but maybe he needs to get more of a fiery personality where he just demands the ball each time.
Well, if you're going to be the top pick in the NBA draft, you can't be a role player, which is, I guess, what those prospects are, or those reports are kind of hinting at. But yeah, you know, Cody's never going to be a guy who shoots 20 times a game. You know, he's a great passer, and that's one of his best attributes, is the fact that he is unselfish and that he is willing to move the ball. But for IU's sake, there are times when he really needs to look for a shot more, and I think Butler was probably one of those games.
Agreed. And, I mean, one thing to say, though, is this isn't the end of the world. Butler's a good team. One loss isn't going to change much. This isn't college football where they're knocked out of championship game contention. They're going to be completely fine going forward. And in a lot of ways, like we already talked about, I think in a way it's good, just because this is really a reality check. And now Kareen has license to kind of have them work on specific things now that they maybe didn't do before. So I don't know. I think it could be good going forward, really.
But if this is the end of the world and the Mayans were right and Friday is in fact our last day, we've had a pretty good run on Podcast on the Brink.
It's been okay.
It's been all right. All right, let's go ahead and wrap up on that overly positive note. We'll definitely be back next week, Mayan calendar or not, to talk more about the Hoosiers. Thanks again to Rick Bozich for coming on the program. Always enjoy talking to him. And Greg, best of luck to your Wizards. I know they need it.
And the Redskins going to the playoffs.
Oh, man, for another time. All right, everyone, thanks for listening. Check back with Inside the Hall. Until then, for Greg Rosenstein, I'm Matt Dollinger. Thanks for listening, and have a good one.